Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. New York, this is Democracy Now!
I can't tell you how intense it was, how terrifying it was, how scary it was. The sound was very loud, very terrifying and scary. Honestly.
In a terrifying show of force, Israel bombs Lebanon over 100 times in 10 minutes Wednesday, killing at least 250 people, injuring more than 1,000. It's a major military escalation amidst the fragile ceasefire between the U.S. and Iran. We'll go to Beirut for a report. Then, in response to Israel's assault on Lebanon, Iran's locked down the Strait of Hormuz. But the United States is still claiming victory.
Operation Epic Fury was a historic and overwhelming victory on the battlefield. A capital V military victory.
We'll speak with Robert Pape of the University of Chicago. His latest piece headlined, "The War is Turning Iran into a Major World Power." And finally, what has the war meant for Gulf states that have been on the front lines of the conflict?
Along with our Gulf partners, we've thus far intercepted 1,700 ballistic missiles and one-way attack drones, defending our forces and our partners in the civilian population. And we remain ready to do so should the need arise.
We'll speak with Yasmin Farouk of the International Crisis Group. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Lebanon's declared a day of national mourning after Israel launched its deadliest wave of bombing since resuming large-scale attacks in early March. The devastating attacks began without warning Wednesday, striking Beirut, the Bekaa Valley, Mount Lebanon, Sidon, and villages across southern Lebanon. Lebanon's health ministry said at least 203 people were killed and more than 1,000 injured. Civil defense workers put the death toll even higher at over 250. The attacks struck commercial areas and apartment high-rises and included Sunni Muslim and Christian neighborhoods in central Beirut that are not affiliated with Hezbollah. Belgium's foreign minister, who survived the Israeli strikes just a few hundred yards from the Belgian embassy, wrote on X, quote, "Just before I was commending President Aoun for offering to open official negotiations with Israel towards a ceasefire, Israel launched with no previous warning one of the most massive strikes since the beginning of the hostilities. The ceasefire between the U.S., Israel, and Iran must include Lebanon," the Belgian foreign minister wrote. The United Nations and world leaders quickly condemned the attacks, which came just hours after the U.S. and Iran announced a two-week ceasefire agreement. Pakistan's prime minister, Shehbaz Sharif, who helped broker the deal, called on all parties to exercise restraint and respect the ceasefire as agreed upon. Both Sharif and the Speaker of the Iranian Parliament had said the ceasefire was supposed to include Lebanon. But on Wednesday, Trump officials, including Vice President J.D. Vance, said Lebanon was not part of the deal.
I think this comes from a legitimate misunderstanding. I think the Iranians thought that the ceasefire included Lebanon, and it just didn't. We never made that promise.
President Trump warned Iran that U.S. forces will remain deployed across the Middle East until a, quote, real agreement, unquote, is reached between the two countries. Trump's threat came as Iranian media reported Tehran is considering pulling out of the ceasefire deal with Washington amidst Israel's stepped-up assault on Lebanon and conflicting accounts over the Strait of Hormuz. On Wednesday, the White House denied reports that Iran continues to control shipping flowing through the waterway, with Press Secretary Carolyn Leavitt citing a, quote, uptick of traffic, unquote. According to ship tracking data, just four vessels passed through the waterway Wednesday with their transponders turned on. That compares to an average of 140 vessels per day before the U.S. and Israeli attacks. In the Gaza Strip, an Israeli drone strike Wednesday killed Al Jazeera Mubasher correspondent Mohammed Wishaa as he was traveling along the coastal road that runs west of Gaza City. The attack caused his car to burst into flames. Seven bystanders were reportedly injured. Wishaa joins a long list of Al Jazeera journalists killed by Israeli forces in Gaza, including Samer Abu Dhaka, Hamza al-Dadu, Ismail al-Ghul, Ahmed al-Lou, and Hossam Shabbat. Gaza's media office says Wishaa's killing reflects a, quote, systematic targeting and assassination, unquote, of Palestinian journalists by Israel. His death brings the total number of journalists killed in Gaza since October 2023 to 262. Al Jazeera says it will pursue legal action against those responsible. At least 326 aid workers were killed in the line of duty across 21 countries last year, bringing the three-year death toll to more than 1,000. That's according to the UN's top aid coordinator, Tom Fletcher, who briefed the UN Security Council on Wednesday. More than 560 of those deaths occurred in Gaza and the occupied West Bank, 130 in Sudan, 60 in South Sudan, and 25 each in Ukraine and the Democratic Republic of Congo. The International Committee of the Red Cross warned the UN Security Council, quote, "We are losing our humanity in war," unquote. This is UN Humanitarian Chief Tom Fletcher.
These trends, alongside the collapse in funding for our life-saving work, are a symptom of a lawless, bellicose, selfish, and violent world. Killing humanitarians is part of the broader attack on the UN Charter and on international humanitarian law.
Here in New York, about 500 anti-war demonstrators led by Jewish Voice for Peace gathered Wednesday outside the home of Comptroller Mark Levine, protesting his plans to invest New York City pension funds in Israeli bonds, which provide resources for Israel's bombing of Iran, Lebanon, and Gaza, they said. Joining the emergency Passover Seder was Mahmoud Khalil, the Columbia University student activist and prisoner who was jailed by ICE for over 100 days beginning in March of last year.
Levine says it's profitable to invest in the Israeli bonds. He says that they are solid investments with high returns. It's not surprising that a war economy is profitable. That's what Israel economy is. It's a war economy. That's why there is high yields. But buying these bonds only ensures the injustice and the system of occupation continues.
President Trump met with NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte at the White House Wednesday amidst growing threats to pull the U.S. from the military alliance. After the meeting, Trump lashed out on social media, saying in all caps, quote, "NATO wasn't there when we needed them, and they won't be there if we need them again. Remember, Greenland, that big, poorly run piece of ice," 3 exclamation points. Meanwhile, the Wall Street Journal reports the Trump administration is considering moving U.S. troops out of NATO member countries Spain and Germany as punishment for not supporting the U.S. in its war on Iran. The Trump administration's once again seeking to eliminate a federal program that helps low-income households pay heating and cooling bills. It's the sixth time a White House budget proposal under President Trump has proposed eliminating LIHEAP, the low-income home energy assistance program. Its cancellation would impact at least 6 million low-income households at a time of spiraling energy costs, saving about $4 billion in annual spending. Meanwhile, a new analysis finds deep cuts to federal funding for food assistance in Trump's so-called One Big Beautiful Bill led to 2.5 million fewer Americans receiving SNAP benefits in the second half of 2025. This comes as the White House has proposed a record-shattering $1.5 trillion Pentagon budget for the next fiscal year. Voters in Georgia's 14th congressional district have elected Republican Clay Fuller to replace Marjorie Taylor Greene, a former top ally of Donald Trump, who resigned from Congress last year after breaking with the president over Gaza, the spiraling cost of health care, and the Epstein files. Fuller is a lieutenant colonel in the Georgia Air National Guard, who worked as a fellow at the White House during Trump's first term. His victory over Democrat Sean Harris preserves the Republican Party's narrow majority in the House of Representatives. But Fuller won by fewer than 12 percentage points in a district Trump carried by 37 points in the 2024 election. Another sign that Republicans are poised for historic losses in November's midterm elections. Meanwhile, in Wisconsin, appeals court judge Chris Taylor was elected to a 10-year term on the state Supreme Court in Tuesday's election. Her victory over a conservative opponent expands the liberal majority on Wisconsin's Supreme Court amidst partisan fights over abortion rights, voting rights, and labor laws. In North Carolina, federal prosecutors have charged a former civilian employee at the Fort Bragg Army base with sharing classified defense information with a journalist. An indictment accuses 40-year-old Courtney Williams with violating the 1917 Espionage Act, as well as multiple non-disclosure agreements, after she spoke with journalist Seth Harp about sexual and race-based harassment at Fort Bragg. Harp published his findings in his book, The Fort Bragg Cartel, and in a Politico magazine article. FBI Director Kash Patel announced Williams' arrest in a social media post, writing, quote, "This FBI will not tolerate those who seek to betray our country and put Americans in harm's way," unquote. Seth Harp responded in a statement, quote, "Ironically, while the FBI was monitoring my phone and investigating Courtney on vague and weak charges, the perpetrators of half a dozen murders involving Fort Bragg soldiers involved in the drug trade have gone entirely unsolved. A real police agency would go after real criminals instead of engaging in this sort of penny-ante political theater," unquote. To see our interview with journalist Seth Harp about U.S. Special Forces involvement in drug trafficking and murder at Fort Bragg, visit our website, democracynow.org. Former Attorney General Pam Bondi will not appear before the House Oversight Committee for her scheduled April 14th deposition on the Epstein files. The Justice Department says Bondi was subpoenaed in her capacity as Attorney General and doesn't have to testify because she no longer holds that office. Trump removed Bondi from her role last week over the Justice Department's handling of the Epstein files. Last month, Bondi and Deputy Attorney General Todd Blanche appeared for a closed-door briefing with the House Oversight Committee, prompting a walkout by Democrats who demanded Bondi testify under oath. Democratic Congressmember Robert Garcia said in a statement that the congressional subpoena is binding regardless of her firing as AG, saying, quote, "Our bipartisan subpoena is to Pam Bondi, whether she's attorney general or not. She must come in to testify immediately, and if she defies the subpoena, we will begin contempt charges," unquote. Republican Congressmember Nancy Mace said, quote, Pam Bondi was subpoenaed by name, not by title, unquote. Meanwhile, Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick will voluntarily meet with the committee next month to answer questions about his connection to the late convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. The Epstein files show Lutnick remained in contact with Epstein for years, even after Lutnick claimed to have cut off ties. Lutnick and his family and their nannies visited Epstein's island in 2012, 4 years after Epstein pleaded guilty to soliciting a minor for prostitution. And here in New York, about 150 workers at ProPublica held a 24-hour strike Wednesday to demand their first collective bargaining agreement since they organized a union in 2023. Workers are seeking higher salaries, protections against layoffs, and agreement over the use of artificial intelligence. This is Katie Campbell, a documentary filmmaker and journalist at ProPublica.
We've heard at the bargaining table that we're special and that we are not a factory. We're not factory workers making widgets. But I think that all workers, regardless of industry, deserve job protections. And we shouldn't be any different than people who are working in factories or who are nurses or who are teachers. We should be able to have the same kind of job protections that other workers in other industries have.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Lebanon's declared a day of mourning after Israeli attacks on Wednesday killed over 250 people and injured 1,000 others. At one point, Israel launched 100 strikes in just 10 minutes. Lebanon's president, Joseph Aoun, condemned the attacks as barbaric and accused Israel of carrying out a new massacre. The strikes came as the Israeli government and the Trump administration claim the Iran ceasefire does not extend to Lebanon. But top diplomats have disagreed. When the ceasefire was first announced, Pakistan's Prime Minister Shahbaz Sharif said, quote, Iran and the United States of America, along with their allies, have agreed to an immediate ceasefire everywhere, including Lebanon and elsewhere, effective immediately, unquote. The Belgian Foreign Minister, Maxime Prévot, was in Beirut on Wednesday. He said Israeli missiles struck just a few hundred meters from where he was at the Belgian embassy. He wrote, quote, just before, I was commending President Aoun for offering to open official negotiations with Israel towards a ceasefire. Israel launched, with no previous warning, one of the most massive strikes since the beginning of the hostilities. This must stop. The ceasefire between the U.S., Israel, and Iran must include Lebanon, the Belgian foreign minister wrote. Iran's deputy foreign minister told the BBC that the Israeli attacks on Lebanon were a grave violation of the U.S.-Iran ceasefire. Residents of Beirut expressed shock at the Israeli assault.
There's something unbelievable. Destruction. Very massive destruction. I mean, even someone who isn't afraid would become afraid. I feel fear and anxiety. Where is this country headed? What are we going to do with our lives? Where are we staying? Where are we going? No one knows what's going to happen. We have children, livelihoods, property. People want to live. Enough. We've had enough of war.
The Israeli strikes on central Beirut hit Shia Muslim and Christian communities not affiliated with Hezbollah. Meanwhile, southern Lebanon has been effectively cut off from the rest of the country after Israel bombed seven key bridges. Lebanese officials closed the last remaining bridge in the area after Israel threatened to destroy that one as well. On Wednesday, an Israeli military spokesperson said the area south of the Litani River was disconnected from Lebanon. Israel's threatened to keep occupying large areas of southern Lebanon, where more than 1 million people have been displaced. We go now to Beirut, where we're joined by Ramzi Qais, Lebanon researcher at Human Rights Watch. We thank you so much for being with us. Can you talk about what's happened in just the last 24 hours, the areas hit, the massive damage, the number of lives lost, Ramzi?
Thanks, Amy, and thank you for having me. So yesterday morning, many people across the country woke up to the news shared in the early morning by Pakistan's prime minister that Lebanon was indeed part of the ceasefire agreement. This was a sigh of relief to millions across the country, and particularly to the hundreds of thousands, over 1 million people that had been displaced since March. And in the early morning hours, we began to see videos and photos circulating on social media and WhatsApp groups, showing displaced people packing up their cars and heading back south of Litani to their homes. But then shortly afterwards at 6 a.m., Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, issued a statement indicating that Lebanon was not part of that agreement. And soon people in the country discovered that by fire. There had been strikes in the early morning hours on the southern Lebanese city of Saida that killed 8 people. There were reports of strikes on medical vehicles in southern Lebanon, and strikes continued throughout the day. A few hours after Netanyahu's statement, Israel's Arabic military spokesperson issued what is now, you know, a typical overbroad displacement order, ordering all residents south of the Zahrani River. This is an area that's approximately 15% of Lebanon's territory, to evacuate north of that river. And then shortly after 2 p.m., we began hearing loud, very loud, Israeli fighter jets roaring in the skies and strikes happening across the country. I was in Beirut at the time, and we didn't know where those strikes were taking place. They came without any warning in advance of the strikes, and they took place in densely populated neighborhoods in the middle of the day. The strikes brought down entire buildings that were packed with people. They happened while people were in the streets going around their business. I was driving across the city and could see smoke rising from various places across Beirut, and see ambulances streaming into hospitals. Chaos ensued across Beirut. And as you noted, the Lebanon's Ministry of Health has announced that there's been over 203 people killed thus far. This is not a final toll, and over 1,000 people injured. The Lebanese Civil Defense has published a higher number, 254 killed. And until now, people are still being dug from the rubble. Photos are circulating in WhatsApp groups of people that are missing, still under the rubble in the city. Yesterday, with 203 people killed, was the deadliest day in the Hasuri since March 2. More than 10% of everyone that has been killed in Lebanon in Israeli attacks since March 2 was killed in the last 24 hours. Israeli strikes also, Israel by its own admission also said that it was striking areas populated with civilians. But those strikes did not happen with any warning. They also conducted strikes on bridges, significantly damaging the Qasimiyya Bridge, which is the main crossing point into the area south of the Litani River. This comes on the back of repeated strikes on bridges across bridges across the Litani, which threatened to sever the area south of the Litani from the rest of the country. Photos and videos circulating today show that the bombing at the Qasimiyya Bridge had targeted the crossing right next to it, with the crossing literally flying over and landing on the bridge, cutting off access on one side. Tens of thousands of people are still located in the area south of the Litani River. And bridge by bridge, they're being cut off from the rest of the country. This Qasimiyya Bridge is the only lifeline for these tens of thousands of people who depend on it for access to humanitarian aid, to food. Hospitals depend on it for medical supplies and health aid. And so by all means of the word, yesterday was a catastrophic day for Lebanon. It was disastrous. Unfortunately, we are seeing the humanitarian catastrophe unfold with various threat of it increasing. Israel's Arabic military spokesperson had issued a statement also indicating that Israel intends to conduct more strikes on central Beirut, accusing Hezbollah members of fleeing or leaving the southern suburbs of Beirut and going into Beirut. There's no, you know, end in sight yet to the strikes and to the unlawful patterns that we've repeatedly documented since October 2023 to date.
Can you talk about the communities hit in central Beirut, from Muslims to Christians, not affiliated with Hezbollah?
Yeah, these strikes happened on densely populated areas. They happened all across the city. The Israeli military said they conducted over 100 strikes. They happened on the southern suburbs of Beirut, but they also took place in central Beirut, in areas such as Ain Mraisi or Barbour or Talat Khayat. These are areas that are spread out across Beirut that are densely populated, where tens of people live. And by the Israeli military's own admission, they were conducting strikes on areas populated with civilians. But under the laws of war, parties to a conflict are required to take all feasible precautions to protect civilian harms. But there was no effective or advance warning ahead of these strikes. And the damage that was done to civilian could be felt on the streets with continuous ambulances streaming into hospitals with chaos as people tried to find their missing loved ones, as people struggled to pull people out of the rubble, with children still being stuck in the rubble. It was a disaster that was felt across the city and across the country.
I wanted to go back to that quote of the Belgian foreign minister. His name is Maxime Prevot. He had just arrived in Lebanon. He wrote on X, "Just before I was commending President Aoun for offering to open official negotiations with Israel towards a ceasefire, Israel launched with no previous warning one of the most massive strikes since the beginning of the hostilities, allegedly causing hundreds of civilian victims. We were at the embassy with my delegation just a few hundred meters from where the missile struck. This must stop," the Belgian foreign minister said. "The ceasefire between the U.S., Israel, and Iran must include Lebanon," he said. That was the Belgian foreign minister, Ramzi.
I mean, indeed, all of that took place. And I think that what we witnessed yesterday in terms of the large amount of civilian suffering, of the attacks happening on densely populated areas coming without warning, the scale of it was massive. It was the most, you know, it was the most deadly day since March 2 in Lebanon. But the patterns that we've seen the Israeli military follow in their conduct in Lebanon, as in Gaza, is not new. For 2.5 years, Human Rights Watch and other rights groups have documented repeated unlawful attacks, war crimes committed in Lebanon, crimes against humanity committed in Gaza, and acts of genocide committed in Gaza. And while all of this was happening, states that were funding Israel or that continue to funding Israel continued doing so. Arms kept flowing and transiting through countries that continued to provide military assistance to Israel. Other states, such as Israel's allies, such as the United States, the UK, Germany, the EU, they have real leverage to stop these atrocities from happening. These statements of condemnations that are typically issued by states after such horrifying days, they have no effect on the ground. But there is real leverage that states can levy. They can immediately suspend arms sales and transfer and military assistance to Israel. They can levy targeted sanctions against Israeli officials credibly implicated in abuses. The EU, for example, could suspend the trade pillar of its association agreement with Israel. But we haven't yet seen any effective measures being taken to stop these atrocities. In fact, the silence of states and the continued flow of weapons has only emboldened Israel, where they're not only continuing to commit unlawful acts, but in fact boasting about it and saying that they intend to commit further atrocities. The response from the international community has been limited to words of condemnation, but no effective action has been taken yet in order to stop these atrocities from happening.
Can you talk about the number of medics who have been killed in Lebanon? Do you believe medics are being targeted? What's the number? Over 50?
Yes, over 57, but we don't have the full number yet because we don't have a detailed list of number of medical workers that have been killed yesterday. But as of the day before that, over 57 medical workers have been killed in Lebanon-Israeli attacks since March 2. If we add that to the total number of medical workers killed since October 2023, then we're talking about over 250 medical workers killed in Lebanon. These medical workers have been killed in attacks on civil defense centers, on medical vehicles, on hospitals. As Human Rights Watch, we and others have documented apparently deliberate and repeated attacks on medical workers in their vehicles, in their civil defense centers, at hospitals that we found amount to apparent war crimes. In our investigation, in Amnesty's investigation, investigations done by international media outlets such as The Guardian, we didn't find evidence of any of these healthcare facilities being used for military purposes in a way that would strip them of their protected status. And this is a claim that has been repeatedly made by the Israeli authorities without evidence. The toll is high, and the damage that is conducted by Israel when it strikes medical workers isn't just limited to the personnel that are tragically killed. It has compounding effects on the rest of the country as access to medical access to aid to